Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for listening to The World. You already know that our team works hard to find fresh angles and unique voices when we bring you the news. Our stories are global, but we aim to keep the focus local with the people on the ground living close to the day's events. We're able to keep our coverage free and accessible and reach millions of people each week because listeners like you support our nonprofit newsroom. This is our fall fundraising drive, which means it is the perfect time to donate. If you give before November 30th and help us reach our goal, your gift will be matched. That means your support will go twice as far in helping us bring you the news. So if you've been thinking about donating but haven't yet, now is your chance. We can't do this without you. Visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
In Austria, COVID cases are spiking, so the government has told unvaccinated people, stay home or pay a steep fine.
Because these measures are so strict and so steep, people are arguing that it's basically making vaccination compulsory if you want to participate in society. And a lot of people say that's not democratic.
Also today, President Biden meets virtually with China's Chairman Xi. Arguably the most important thing for the two leaders, just talking again without drama.
You know, meet and have a business-like conversation. I think that's the most important thing they're going to do.
I'm Marco Werman, and tactical driving. What does it take to chauffeur a head of state in danger?
If you're going to back up and spin a car or go from, remember the old Rockford file turn? You know, if you're really going to spin a car forward, and you have to really think about, where am I going?
We'll tell you where he's going and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here on a Monday. The UN Climate Summit wrapped up this weekend in Glasgow.
Hearing no objections, it is so decided.
Negotiators from the nearly 200 participating nations hammered out the most forceful set of agreements yet to combat climate change. A few highlights: strong language underscoring the importance of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius and pledging more money for adaptation. Hopeful signs, but we're talking words and promises. Nearly every climate envoy or minister left Glasgow saying much more needs to be done and fast. So why does this gap between ambition and action persist? The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler in Glasgow starts us off today inside the negotiation hall.
After 2 weeks of closed-door negotiations, the diplomatic theater of COP26 unfolded in public on Saturday. Small groups of negotiators stood talking to each other between tables on the floor of the UN plenary hall, delaying a meeting that was supposed to have started an hour earlier. Juan Pablo Orsonio from Greenpeace was watching from the back of the room.
You're seeing the last stretch when you put in your best players and you try to get a little bit more right before the actual deal is presented and voted up or down.
Orsonio pointed out the two biggest players in the room, the climate envoys for the U.S. and China.
We just saw John Kerry walk across the room and meet with Xi. So this is a powerful image right here, which, of course, the whole room is turning their heads and watching attentively.
Earlier in the day, a scrum of people pressed close around Kerry and representatives from Gabon and Guinea as they argued about a section on carbon markets. Orsonio says Kerry was essentially whipping the vote here, trying to make sure everyone would approve of the text.
This all happened in an open forum, right? So this is part of the theater, right? I'm sure that Kerry and everybody else wanted to show the world what was happening, what was the holdup, to put pressure on governments to accept the deal.
Right before that deal was set to be adopted, India, backed by China, asked for a change to the section that mentions fossil fuels for the very first time in COP history. Earlier in the day, Indian Environment Minister Bhupender Yadav made the case for watering down the language.
Fossil fuels and their use have enabled parts of the world to attain high levels of wealth and well-being. Developing countries have a right to their fair share of the global carbon budget and are entitled to the responsible use of fossil fuels within this scope.
India's request led to another flurry of rapid negotiations. Nick Mabey, who runs an environmental think tank, pointed to what he called a feral meeting of the European Council near the front of the room.
The Europeans are just meeting in front of us in the European Council, and hopefully they will come up with a form of language that keeps everybody in the room and COP finishing on time.
India was successful in its last-minute push.
On the text of Para 20, of discussion of 1/COP26.
The final wording of the agreement calls for parties to phase down instead of phase out dirty coal. As the COP president, Alok Sharma, moved to ratify the deal, he choked up twice.
I think today we can say with credibility that we have kept 1.5 degrees within reach, but its pulse is weak. And it will only survive if we keep our promises, if we translate commitments into rapid action.
The last moments of the negotiations illustrate how challenging it is for the UN body to make the kinds of sweeping changes needed to keep global warming at the safest possible levels. Helen Mountford from the World Resources Institute does see some hope in the agreement.
We've made some serious progress in closing the gaps, but nowhere near enough. What we have done, though, is the negotiators have agreed specific approaches to actually try and close those gaps going forward.
Pledges submitted at this summit overshoot the 1.5 degree target by a lot. The agreement requests countries to come back to the table next year in the hopes that they can commit to bigger cuts. But the final climate deal left representatives of vulnerable nations particularly unsatisfied.
Well, I'm very disappointed because we came here to get a concrete outcome.
Aminath Shana is the environment minister from the Maldives.
It's not what we wanted. And it's not what is needed for the Maldives and small islands.
Vulnerable nations came to COP26 with a set of demands that went largely unmet. Developed countries haven't delivered the $100 billion a year by 2020 they pledged to help developing nations on climate change. Countries didn't deliver the balance at the summit. Instead, the COP26 decision expressed deep regret that they'd so far failed on their pledge and offered to boost financing for adaptation. The agreement also sets up a formal framework for setting new finance goals for 2025. Tina Stege from the Marshall Islands says this will continue to be a key issue for vulnerable nations.
We need to have some of this financing flow so that those countries like mine can make the transformations that they need to make, particularly in terms of adaptation.
Developing countries also didn't get the fund for climate damages they asked for. What they got instead was a promise for a dialogue. Salimiel Huck, an advisor to vulnerable nations, says that at least opens the door for progress at the next summit.
We'll come back next year in COP27 in Egypt, which will be an African COP where this issue will be on our agenda. It wasn't here. We will do that in Egypt, and then we'll take it from there.
The summit did finalize one of the trickiest issues left from the Paris Agreement, the rules for global carbon markets. Even so, Huck says the COP26 deal should have been more ambitious.
Incremental progress is good, but incremental progress is simply not enough. What we need is transformational.
As negotiators left the meeting hall late Saturday night, they were already talking about plans for COP27. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Their ancestral home is in Myanmar, but in recent years, more than 1 million Rohingya Muslims have fled their country, escaping a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing carried out by Myanmar's military. They now live in sprawling refugee camps in nearby Bangladesh. Their troubles, sadly, do not end there. The UN has said they deserve a safe sanctuary. Local authorities in Bangladesh, though, have allowed the camps to fall under the sway of criminal gangs. The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is on the line. You've been to these refugee camps before, Patrick. What are they like?
Well, Marco, just picture these rolling hills of brown dirt packed tight with flimsy shelters like tents or huts. super crowded, lots of people, a small presence of aid workers. And during the day, the Bangladeshi police are there walking around. But the problem is really what happens after dark. Essentially, gangs take over. Some have guns. Increasingly, they extort people. Increasingly, they kidnap people for ransom. And they have assassinated people who speak out against them. Like in recent months, there have been 8 people killed specifically for standing up to these gangs. I spoke to a Rohingya activist named Nay San Wen. He knows the camps really well, and he told me this criminality is just really traumatizing for people who've already suffered one of the worst genocidal campaigns in modern times.
I cannot compare the criminal group with the genocide perpetrator, but the fear is the same.
The fear is the same. Wow. Who are the gang members, Patrick, and where do they come from?
Well, some are just run-of-the-mill gangs extorting people. But the main illegal force in the camps, Marco, is called ARSA, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. They started as a guerrilla insurgency movement in Myanmar, standing up to the military, often with just sticks and knives. The military responded by smearing all Rohingya as terrorists, and then they looted, killed, raped people, drove them out of the country. That's why there's so many people in the camps. Now you have elements of ARSA more recently becoming a violent bullying force inside the camps. So when I was there several years back, just the mention of their name kind of freaked people out. And I'm told now it's so bad that no one goes out after dark. And this group, they really do not like other Rohingya standing up to criticize them or even just developing a large following. There was this really charismatic refugee named Mohib Ullah, very well loved in the camps. He went to the UN to advocate for his people. And actually, 2 years ago, he even went to the White House and asked then-President Trump, what is the plan to help us?
What is the plan to help us? So, thank you.
And where is that exactly? Where?
Bangladesh, if you can.
Bangladesh, right next to Burma. The Rohingya have been run out.
Okay.
So, Marco, you can hear Trump say, wait, where is that? So this man, Mohib Ullah, not only does he get brushed off by the U.S. president, he goes back to the camps, and in the ensuing years, this group ARSA, they start sending him death threats. 6 weeks ago, they assassinated him, according to the man's family, simply for speaking out against their criminality. And his killers reportedly said, we are the leaders here, not you. So this is indicative of this rash of killings that is ongoing in these camps and getting worse every month.
So these refugee camps where so many Rohingya Muslims are stuck, they're physically, as we said, in Bangladesh. But it sounds from you, Patrick, like the gangs are extremely active and present. So who's actually in charge of these places and what are they doing to provide more security?
Who is in charge of security? That's Bangladesh. The activist I spoke to, Nay San Wen, he told me ultimately it is the job of Bangladeshi authorities to impose order. But Bangladesh is a crowded country before the Rohingya showed up without much money, and they say they don't really have the resources to care for 1 million refugees. So they're really in limbo. What you have now is probably one of the biggest refugee camps in the world, if not the biggest, becoming easy prey for these criminal groups. And you will hear Rohingya say often they feel they're living in an open-air prison. And you know, this is a phenomenon you see in most prisons, gangs forming to rule through violence.
Patrick, Myanmar is in the news today for another reason. As a lot of people have now learned, American journalist Danny Fenster was released from prison in Myanmar. He got on a plane to return to the U.S. What more can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, this story has really had some gut-wrenching twists and turns. Last week, Bill Richardson, the former U.N. ambassador, went and sat down with the leaders of Myanmar's military to supposedly get Danny Fenster out of prison. He left without Danny in his plane. After that, Danny Fenster gets hit with another round of really serious, absurd charges for terror and sedition, and it looks like he's going to spend the next 11 years in prison. And then all of a sudden, he's pardoned out of nowhere by Myanmar's courts, and he was able to get on a plane with Bill Richardson and go back to the U.S. So this is really good news for this American journalist, Danny Fenster. This is really good news for anybody who cares about journalists not being persecuted. But the sad fact is, Marco, there are dozens of Myanmar journalists in prison, and there's no UN, former UN ambassador coming to save them. And that's on top of thousands of other people in prison in Myanmar for political crimes. So I think that is what Danny would want everybody to know, even as he's being released. There are others still in the prison that he's been released from, and they are in very bad shape.
There was Patrick Nguyen bringing us up to speed on the release from a prison in Myanmar of U.S. journalist Danny Fenster and filling us in on the deteriorating security situation for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. Really appreciate your time today, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, you're the driver for a foreign dignitary just trying to get them from point A to B. Then bad guys start chasing you. What do you do? This is not Hollywood. This is real life. We'll meet one of the trainers who teaches chauffeurs evasive action. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. In Austria this weekend, demonstrators took to the streets to protest a move to separate the jabbed from the jabbed nots. Beginning today, Austrians older than 12 and unvaccinated for COVID are not allowed to leave their homes except for essential reasons like grocery shopping or seeing the doctor. The selective lockdown comes as Austria is facing its worst surge in COVID infections since the pandemic began. Reporter Catherine Edwards joins us from Vienna. How are these new regulations actually going to be enforced, Catherine?
So essentially, it's the police who will be carrying out checks, and that will be both by incorporating checks of people's vaccine certificates at regular police checks, for example, traffic stops, and extra police patrols will also be targeting busy areas. But the difficulty in enforcing it is one of the major causes for criticism of the new measure.
Yes, yeah, so certain places like cafes, restaurants, and bars, will police enter those spaces and check people randomly?
In fact, in those places like bars and restaurants, the rule of vaccinated people only has already been in place for the past week. The difference now is that unvaccinated people are also banned from all non-essential shops, as well as being outside their homes, except for those essential reasons.
So does all this imply that the Austrian police are themselves fully vaccinated?
The vaccination rate among the police is slightly higher than average. It's about 84% for police compared to nationwide, it's about 75% of the eligible population, which is around 65% of the general population. So yes, police officers do include some unvaccinated people.
So I understand the fines if you are found to be out and about and unvaccinated. The fines are pretty stiff. What are people looking at?
The fine is 500 euros, and it's nearly three times as much, 1,450 euros, if you refuse to cooperate with the check. So if you're asked to show your vaccine pass and you don't.
So on the far end for individuals, 1,450 euros, that's about $1,600. That is pretty steep. So generally, how is the public reacting to the lockdown for the unvaccinated?
One of the things people are protesting about is that going to work is one of the exceptions, which causes some confusion because you're telling people it's okay for an unvaccinated person to serve you at a bar or a shop, but the same person can't go into one of those venues. Some of the slogans that people are shouting, there's a lot of "my body, my choice," co-opting a slogan from the pro-women's rights movements, and people protesting against mandatory vaccinations. So because these measures are so strict and so steep, people are arguing that it's basically making vaccination compulsory if you want to participate in society. And a lot of people say that's not democratic.
So I'm really curious, what is the mood right now as these new rules are enacted?
It's become a very divisive topic and there are a lot of different opinions. But there have also been some positive signs. So it has had an effect on the number of people getting their first vaccine dose. So for example, I went to a Christmas market here in Vienna on Sunday, and at first I thought there was a huge queue for the market, but actually it was for a pop-up vaccine center next to the market.
There's one sign of the distaste for these new rules coming from the leader of Austria's far-right opposition Freedom Party. He said he'd combat the new restrictions by all legal means available. That was his quote. And then he announced that he himself had COVID and would have to quarantine instead of attending those protests. Do you think this selective lockdown will boost support for Austria's far right, or will it have the opposite effect?
It's hard to say. I think the Freedom Party, the far right party, has long been a vocal critic of the measures and the vaccination campaign, and they're taking every opportunity to continue that. Perhaps at this point in the pandemic, people have had the chance to inform themselves, so perhaps people know which side they're on already or who they're listening to. But it's certainly galvanizing the existing supporters of the party.
We will leave it there. Reporter Catherine Edwards in Vienna, thanks very much for checking in with us.
Thank you.
Legendary race car driver and driving instructor Bob Bondurant died yesterday. He was 88 years old. After crashing his car and flipping it 8 times and breaking some bones in the process, Bondurant decided some years ago to become a driving instructor. He taught Hollywood celebrities like Paul Newman, Clint Eastwood, and Christian Bale. What's less known is that Bondurant also taught tactical driving to security teams for heads of state from around the world. We called up his former school, but they said they could not disclose any details. Someone who can talk about tactical driving and how it can protect important people is Anthony Ricci. He runs Advanced Driving and Security, Inc. I know there are certain things you also can't mention, Anthony, names of clients, for example, but who are the kinds of people you've trained and the people they drove for?
We've trained people from Fortune 500 companies. Name a large company, and they've probably been through our doors. Movie stars, executives, military, and law enforcement.
And what about heads of state from places overseas or foreign generals?
We've trained people from as far as the Slovak Republic, Bogota, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, all over.
And when those countries, those executives of state come to you, what are they looking for? What are their drivers looking for?
Our primary focus is they're protecting a principle, and that principle is worth a large amount of money. If a CEO or a head of state anywhere was kidnapped or captured, it's a huge ramification of what can happen in the world, whether it be the stock market or decision making for a country changes.
Anthony, what are some of the important but maybe kind of wild maneuvers you teach drivers? I mean, if we're talking heads of state, are we talking evasive maneuvers? I mean, do you teach them how to do a 180 in a limousine?
Nowadays, you're using an Audi, you're using a nice large car, but nothing like a limousine. But as far as the maneuvers go, absolutely. We love to talk about glitz and glamour and what we see on TV, but the real world, unfortunately, if you're going to back up and spin a car or go from, remember the old Rockford file turn, and you have to really think about, where am I going? If someone's chasing me and I spin that car, they're just going to box me in. If there's a barricade in front, people, bad guys with guns, and there they are in front of you, and you spin the car. Well, are you putting yourself at risk? Could I have gone around it just as quickly? But quite honestly, I teach it so my drivers know how to take the car out of control and bring it back under control, and they understand the fine motor skills that it takes to actually make that maneuver. This is what we teach, is safe driver training. So if you can avoid a crash, you can avoid an ambush. It's the same thing.
Well, I was really intrigued by what you said earlier about, being a good driver. I'm guessing you have used some of these skills.
One time I was driving a certain exercise, and the guy said, "Wow, you've done this so much, you could do it blindfolded." I started closing. This is crazy. People listening to this is going to say, "Well, this guy's really out of his mind." But we do a slalom drill, and I started to close my eyes on the first cone and negotiate through this slalom and get out of it, open my eyes. And I asked around, I was like, how'd I do? And people were like, "You made it." And I was like, "Holy crap."
Anthony, have any of your drivers ever called you up and told you about how they use skills you taught them to protect themselves or someone they work for?
Yeah. I've had teams that went into Mexico. There was a team coming back, and they had a big scare moment where a group of guys, maybe 5 or 6 guys on the side of the road, came up with guns and started shooting right as they passed by. So as they're going by, these guys rise up, and they said, "We had a pucker moment. We thought we were goners, and we just floored it and got out of there."
I first heard about Bob Bondurant in the 1970s. What will be his legacy in this kind of arcane field of driver security? I mean, what kind of knowledge did he leave you?
He was a leader in the industry. I personally didn't know him. I read his book. I used his materials more for the racetrack than security training, to be quite honest with you. He'll surely be missed. He's trained hundreds of thousands of people. It's a huge loss for the industry.
Anthony Ricci teaches drivers the tactical skills needed to protect important people that they drive. Anthony, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The World. COVID vaccines were developed in remarkable record-breaking time. Developing drugs to prevent the disease, also essential in getting through this. That requires unprecedented global cooperation.
I suggested to everyone, we are working together, so let's give the name together to our trial, because this is all about collaboration.
Together in the Lab, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A taxi driver in the English city of Liverpool is being hailed for taking heroic action and possibly preventing many deaths. British police say an explosion outside of a hospital in Liverpool yesterday is being treated as a terrorist incident. One man died at the scene. Four others have since been arrested. For more, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us now. What do we know at this point, Orla, about what happened on Sunday at the Liverpool Women's Hospital?
So a man hailed a taxi and got it to bring him to the hospital, as you said. And just before the taxi pulled up to the drop-off point outside the hospital, there was an explosion in the back of the cab. The taxi driver, David Perry, he managed to escape the cab, in fact, and there is footage of it. You see him jumping out from the front of the car and he locked the passenger doors as he jumped out, and doing so meant, I guess, the passenger wasn't able to get out of the back seat, but he died in the blaze. The driver, as you said, has been praised. The mayor of Liverpool praised his actions today and said he saved possibly many, many lives. Later last night, police said that they had arrested three people who they believe are associates of the passenger in the backseat, and also they arrested a fourth man today. And then this evening, we understand that a controlled explosion was carried out at another park in Liverpool that police say is connected with the explosion yesterday at the hospital.
Do we know yet the reasons why the police there are describing this as a terrorist incident?
It's not yet clear. We do know when they declare it a terrorist incident or they arrest someone under the Terrorism Act, they're able to hold on to them for 14 days. So that gives them a little bit of leeway in terms of the investigation, etc. The head of counterterrorism policing in the northwest of England, Russ Jackson, was speaking at a police press conference earlier, and he said that he believed the passenger in the cab was the one who made the explosive.
It is not clear what the motivation for this incident is. Our inquiries indicate that an improvised explosive device has been manufactured, and our assumption so far is that it was built by the passenger in the taxi. The reason why he then took it to the women's hospital is unknown, as is the reason for its sudden explosion.
Orla, what is the government in London saying about all of this?
Yeah, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, he was holding a press conference about COVID this afternoon. But at the start of the conference, he talked about what happened in Liverpool yesterday.
Following the sickening attack outside Liverpool Women's Hospital yesterday, my thoughts remain with all those affected on the independent Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, JTAC, are today raising the UK's threat level from substantial to severe, meaning an attack is highly likely. But what yesterday showed above all is that the British people will never be cowed by terrorism. We will never give in to those who seek to divide us with senseless acts of violence.
And he said after that that raising the level to severe, it wasn't just reflective of this one incident. It was a reflective of a number of incidents, he said, in recent times. The one that we will remember in the last month was the attack on David Amos, the Conservative MP, who was stabbed to death in his constituency clinic. Raising it to severe effectively means an attack is highly likely, but not imminent. And in fact, the highest level that they can raise it to is critical. And at that point, it means that an attack in the UK is imminent. But that's not where we're at just yet. This evening, we did hear that all hospitals in the UK are to be told that they'll have to review the security procedures in light of the explosion.
The World's Orla Barry speaking with us from London. Thank you very much, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
Solidarity, recovery, together. Not just rallying words for the pandemic, there are the actual names of clinical trials that are helping doctors better understand what drugs work and don't work for treating COVID-19. Many scientists say drug research is as important as vaccine research for getting through the pandemic. The World's Alana Gordon reports.
In March of 2020, Dr. Gilmar Reis, a Brazilian cardiologist and researcher, watched in horror as disease and death swept over Italy. Back then, doctors responded to COVID with what they had, and it wasn't much. Then the virus hit home.
We had the worst case scenarios in COVID-19. You see the patients come back 1 or 2 days later in a respiratory failure. They got intubated and 80% of them died. So it's quite frustrating.
Reis is based in central Brazil at Pontifical Católica University in Minas Gerais, the country's third most populous state. It has a real cross-section of Brazilian society, which he says has long made it an ideal hub for clinical research.
Usually everything we try to design in Brazil, we test before in Minas Gerais. That's amazing.
Reese connected with Ed Mills, a researcher at McMaster University in Canada.
When the pandemic struck, the majority of clinical trials that were getting funded were being done in North America and the UK. And my immediate thoughts went to my colleagues in the Global South.
Mills and Reese joined forces. And what was different is that they designed a system that could test multiple drugs and adapt as new evidence from around the world came in. 11 Brazilian cities signed on. Community health centers recruited thousands of volunteers who had COVID. They then get randomly assigned an actual drug or a placebo.
So it's a very efficient way of looking at data.
They called it the Together Trial.
I suggested to everyone, okay, we are working together. So that was nice because this is all about collaboration.
They wanted to look at high-risk people before they got really sick. So far, they've been looking into 9 interventions. Some are familiar, like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. They saw clear signs that those weren't helping. Hate mail started flooding in from all over.
If I go into my social media and read the messages, you know, we think that we are the worst person in the world.
Recently, the group published results for a different drug that's far less controversial, fluvoxamine. It's an antidepressant that also has some anti-inflammatory properties. They went with it after a small study out of Washington University caught their attention. In their own research of 1,500 people, they found it reduced the need for hospitalization by about a third.
I was very happy with that because at that time in August, we didn't have anything to use that could help patients on early phase of COVID-19.
Since then, new antivirals have been announced but not approved from Pfizer and Merck. But something stands out about fluvoxamine.
It's cheap. It only costs $4 for a course of treatment. It's particularly important to countries that currently don't have any treatment.
The World Health Organization is still waiting for more data to come in before issuing a recommendation. Natalie Dean is a statistician specializing in clinical trials at Emory University. She wasn't involved in the research, but says it's hard to generalize about drugs based on one trial in one location.
Some of it may be sensitive to what are the criteria for who's getting admitted and sort of the capacity of the healthcare system.
Beyond fluvoxamine, Dean sees a big opportunity in this approach of testing multiple drugs across locations in a standardized way. Only a handful of this kind exist. The WHO has organized the Solidarity Trial. It involves 600 hospitals in some 50 countries. And then there's the Recovery Trial, the largest for COVID-19 in the world. Martin Landry of Oxford University co-leads it.
So the Recovery Trial now has nearly 45,000 people in it. The trial's running in every single hospital in the UK. It's about 200 hospitals or so. It's open to every age range, every medical background, social background, and so on.
So far, about 1 in 10 patients admitted in the UK for COVID have taken part. Within months, amid all the noise and confusion, his group identified that a common steroid, dexamethasone, could reduce the risk of dying for patients who were really sick.
We announced that result at lunchtime. At tea time, it was standard practice across the whole of the National Health Service. And within the following days and weeks, it was standard practice all around the world.
The Recovery Trial has been researching 9 different drugs. Landry says picking which ones is a challenge. They received over 200 suggestions, everything from advanced chemotherapies to beeswax. Today in Brazil, cases are down. Dr. Gilmar Reis is still on edge, but he's grateful to those patients who've taken part in his clinical trials.
We plan this trial to help people that is dying, that is suffering, that is getting a lot of relatives that is dying, you know. In Brazil, we have more than 500,000 people that just died from COVID-19. For those people, we designed this trial.
Because of those trials, doctors have more treatment options now. And those trials will continue to try and find better ones. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Our pandemic coverage continues online at theworld.org. And while you're there, check out our recent interview with author Howard French about his new book that gives us a more expansive understanding of the history before, during, and after the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. That's at theworld.org. Artisans in southern Mexico have been crafting small, brightly colored sculptures of mythical creatures for decades. They're called alebrijes. Earlier this month, two 20-foot-tall renditions of a jaguar and an eagle got international exposure at Rockefeller Center in Manhattan. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia recently visited the workshop in Oaxaca, where these works of art were created.
This small, dusty town in the state of Oaxaca is a place of tradition. A brass band is part of a funeral procession. And all over the town of San Martin Tilcahete, artisans make little sculptures that farmers here began carving out of tree branches a long time ago.
My name is Ricardo Ángeles. I am part of the Jacobos and Marias Ángeles workshop.
Ricardo Ángeles welcomes us to the workshop his parents, Jacobo and Maria, founded 30 years ago. About 36 people here made the jaguar and eagle that stood at 30 Rock in New York. And walking through here can feel like walking through Santa's little workshop, except even more magical because they make little creatures that don't look like anything you'd see in real life.
Obviously, it looks fantastic because you don't see a green deer or something like that, but it's a deer. Or we mix a deer with another thing.
The process involves cutting wood with a machete, a knife, and a chisel. They carve dogs, squirrels, owls, or hybrids of different animals. Each figure will be painted with a number of fantastical colors, and the design is dictated by the shape of whatever tree branch they're using. No two sculptures are ever alike. Alfredo Perez is sanding a fish the size of his hand. Perez explains the piece has to be perfectly smooth. He says there can't be any bumps on the wood, so they can trace fine lines and dots on it. Perez works with almost 400 people in the Jacobo and Maria Angeles workshop, and in recent years, their operation has become more modern.
So, come on, let's go upstairs.
This office is where they began the process of making the jaguar and eagle they sent to New York.
Look.
Angeles was actually the person who made the initial design.
Yeah, very, very fancy things like a pencil and a notebook. But all the big things start like that.
Okay, the more modern part of the operation is about the rest of the work he and the dozen or so 20-somethings in this room do.
So we have like a lot of computers here. We have all the process here that is about the human resources.
They also have web designers and social media people. Angeles says the business has grown since the beginning of the pandemic because more people are buying alebrijes online instead of just here at the workshop. And he says even more people started seeking them out after the exhibit at the Rockefeller Center.
I feel very proud of my family. And I feel very proud of our capabilities like artists. And I feel that we are just starting.
Angeles says he feels a big responsibility now that they're probably the best-known workshop in a tradition that goes back generations. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in San Martin Tilcahete, Mexico.
President Biden is meeting with China's leader Xi Jinping today. It's a virtual meeting, but it's still their first one-on-one summit since Biden became president, and there is a lot to discuss. Disagreements over human rights, trade, and cybersecurity have led to sharp confrontations between the two superpowers. To break this all down, we're joined by Susan Thornton. She's a former Assistant Secretary of State for Asia-Pacific Affairs and a senior fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. Susan, set the virtual table for us. As these two world leaders sit down to talk, how would you characterize the current state of U.S.-China relations?
The U.S. and China have not met at the leaders' level now for quite some time. Of course, that has a lot to do with COVID-19 and the pandemic. Xi Jinping hasn't left China since the pandemic. And of course, we've also had a little bit of a rough ride in the relationship. So there's been a lot of things built up over that period of time. I doubt they'll be able to cover everything, but hopefully they'll be able to spend a few hours going over some of the ground that needs to be trod.
So what is at stake? And can you single out the most important issue that Biden wants to bring up with Xi?
What I think is at stake is the reestablishment of normal communications between the U.S. and China. Having the two leaders show that they can meet and have a business-like conversation, I think that's the most important thing they're going to do. There are a lot of issues to bring up, certainly for Biden. We have military tensions in the relationship over Taiwan. But also, I think the global economy and trade tensions between the U.S. and China is going to be a big issue. COVID-19 and the pandemic. And then I think climate change, the US and China announced a working group on climate change out of the Glasgow summit last week, which was a positive step, but maybe there's more detail they can put on that skeleton.
So stepping back for a moment, Susan, the top leadership of the Chinese Communist Party last week put out a historical resolution about Xi Jinping's place in the modern history of China. What is the meaning of such a resolution in the lead up to this meeting with Biden? Is the timing important?
I think, Marco, it's important to understand that the timing of that sixth party plenum, as it's called, has nothing to do with the timing of the Biden-Xi meeting. It's been long expected. So this is a sort of a setting of the stage for Xi Jinping's likely approval for a third term as the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, a third term as president, which would be sort of an unprecedented recent move for a Chinese leader.
So there is some evidence of cooperation, Susan. You mentioned climate change, and last week the U.S. and China announced an agreement on climate. Remind us what that agreement entails, and were you surprised that it happened?
Well, I mean, I think it's not that surprising. The U.S. and China have had climate change partnerships. Of course, it was the U.S. and China announcing their joint commitments that spurred the move toward closing the Paris Climate Accord in 2015. So that is something that is in the sort of muscle memory of a lot of the people in the Biden administration. So I think the framework that was announced last week is a little bit short on detail. I'm hoping that they can put a little bit more detail on the bones of that framework that was announced last week.
Overall, how's the Biden administration doing so far when it comes to the U.S.-China relationship?
Well, they're trying to walk a very difficult line. On the one hand, the competition with China and the need to contest what China's doing seems to have a lot of bipartisan political support in Washington. But on the other hand, they need to get some workmanlike communications going with China to try to work on some of these practical issues that we're facing, but it won't be dramatic progress. There won't be any major breakthroughs. I think that's a good place for both sides to call it for the next year. And maybe they can work on something that they can build on in following years after the domestic political situations are a little bit more easy to deal with.
Well, we should know more by tomorrow morning. Susan Thornton is a senior fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, speaking with us about today's meeting between President Biden and China's leader Xi Jinping. Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This weekend in the Philippines, the daughter of President Rodrigo Duterte threw her hat into the election ring, but not for president, as many had speculated for months. Ashley Westerman reports.
In a simple no-frills video on social media, Sara Duterte Carpio told supporters Sunday that she knew she had disappointed them by not running for president. But she said running for vice president was meeting them halfway.
It's a path that would allow me to heed your call to serve our country and make me a stronger person and public servant in the years that lie ahead. I am here to answer your call.
This last-minute move by Duterte Carpio is not a surprise, says Manila-based analyst Richard Haydarian. He says even though Sara's father, current President Rodrigo Duterte, wanted her to run for president, his daughter likely saw that support and momentum has already started to consolidate around presidential candidate Bongbong Marcos. He is an ally of the Dutertes and the son of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who ruled the Philippines for two decades with an iron fist.
It became prohibitive for Sara to try to challenge the Marcoses because Marcoses are absolutely in no mood to slide down or slide out.
According to the latest polling, Marcos has nearly 50% of the vote, giving him an already significant edge. In the Philippines, vice presidential candidates do not run on an official ticket with the presidential candidate like in the U.S. Still, Haydarian says, with Marcos and Sara so closely aligned, this puts even more pressure on the opposition to rally behind their candidate, current Vice President Leni Robredo.
Leni is positioning herself as essentially the country's savior in a sense of preventing the return of Marcos. And I think that kind of messaging has resonated to a certain degree.
Meanwhile, President Rodrigo Duterte on Monday announced he would be running for Senate. He is constitutionally barred from running for president again. Hedarian notes the president is being investigated by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity for his deadly years-long war on drugs.
Should his allies occupy key positions of the government and him occupying some top national government posts, then that may give him some political cover.
President Duterte remains popular in the Philippines, though analysts say his popularity has waned following the government's disastrous response to the COVID-19 pandemic. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
When Weedy Brema talks about segregation, he isn't talking about race. He's talking about music and musical instruments. Brema plays the djembe, a West African drum that's become something of a global mascot for African music. Now, Brema, who was born in Ghana, is pushing further. With his new album, The Hands of Time, his debut recording as a bandleader, he puts the djembe in front of his band. Reporter Afee Scruggs spoke with Brema about his drum, his music, and his life.
Ask Weedy Brema what he plays, and he won't say drums or percussion.
I'm a djembe fola, and I am one that's trying to make this instrument, the djembe, a respected and sophisticated instrument. No different than your cello, your classical piano, your trumpet, your saxophone.
His instrument, the djembe, is a goblet-shaped hand drum that originated in present-day Mali more than four centuries ago. As a djembe fola, one who speaks through the drum, Brema works to expand the boundaries of his instrument without sacrificing its identity and heritage. On The Hands of Time, Brema and his band fuse hip-hop, folkloric music, and jazz with the help of artists like rapper Maimuna Youssef, a.k.a. Mumu Fresh, and jazz trumpeter and composer Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. But the djembe commands attention. That's not just because Brema loves it. He wants to bridge the divide he sees between percussionists and drummers, which in many bands are seen as different roles, the drummer playing a drum kit.
Now, that's a Western trait because of the miscommunication and misunderstanding of what it is. The more you start going east, you start realizing that these quote-unquote percussion instruments is actually the melody of the music.
The album tells two stories, that of the djembe and Brema's journey to it. His musical roots run deep. His father, Oscar Sully Brema, was a drummer from Ghana. That's where Weedy was born, and that's where he learned to play the drum. When he was about four, the family moved to the United States and settled in Illinois.
My father started this band in Champaign, Urbana, called Bantuku. And in Champaign, there was a club they used to play at called Nature's Table. That was the first band I ever played with. At that time, I was three-four. And it was my mother playing drums, my father on playing flutes, writing the music, and also playing folkloric drums.
Brema did more than play with his father's band. As a child, he memorized every part.
To hear that type of music as a four-year-old and to be able to mimic and say everybody's parts is what used to freak my father and my mom out.
Brema brings those horns and energy into his new album. And he brings something else.
That was a melody that we used to play in the band. The song says, this song is called Back to Forth. That song is an ode to my father about Bantuku.
Just as Back to Forward is for his late father, when the clouds kissed, 2515 is for his late mother, drummer Ann Morris.
She was the only one out of her siblings that pursued music. And she pursued music from looking up to her father, which was Nathaniel Weedy Morris. Now, he played with everybody.
The Morris family has deep roots in New Orleans, where Brema lives now. But his grandfather left the city and eventually ended up in East St. Louis, which had a thriving music scene. Brema's parents broke up because his mother felt her son wasn't comfortable around African Americans. but she didn't want to neglect his African heritage. So when she returned to East St. Louis, she enrolled him in a program teaching African music and dance. Her little boy was used to Ghanaian drums. The drums in East St. Louis were different.
Wow, and I'm looking out saying, excuse me, sir, what's the name of these drums? Oh, these drums are called djembe.
Brahma still plays for the community events and classes that got him started. But his djembe shows up in New Orleans' funky dumpster funk band, at jazz clubs like the Blue Note in New York, and on a 2019 Grammy-nominated album. Then he was a featured musician. Now, with his band and debut album, it's his turn to speak. For the world, I'm Afee Scruggs.
Brahma on the djembe, taking us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Thanks very much for being with us. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.